Philippians 2, making our way through the letter to the Philippians here this fall. Beginning in verse 14, we'll read 14 through 16. It says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God, without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain." This is the word of the Lord. Something about these phrases don't sit right with me. Maybe I should say the way that I hear them. I mean, Paul is talking about very weighty matters. He's speaking of the state of the Philippians' soul on the return of Christ. He's talking about the word of life and being a light in a twisted and crooked generation. He's talking about judgment. He's talking about guilt and innocence. He's speaking about the Holy Scriptures. All of these things are weighty, eternal matters. And what doesn't fit for me is the beginning of the sentence where he says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing." It sounds like Paul is telling us that the way to wage an eternal and epic war against the evils of this world is to be a get-along guy who doesn't complain. It seems like what Paul is saying is the way to present ourselves complete in the faith but on the return of Jesus is not to grumble or whine or dispute with other people. Does this seem odd to anybody else? No? Little after school specialist, maybe? Perhaps that's the religion you were raised on. Perhaps the religion you were raised on was that, there are these big, eternal, weighty things, but the answer is be nice and don't complain. I don't know. I think Paul is talking about something else here. And I think the text bears this out, that I don't think Paul believes that the answer to being presented blameless on the day of Christ is to simply avoid complaining about your lot in life, or that the way to wage a war against a crooked generation is to not, grumble or instead to get along with the people around you. I think there's something more going on here than just mere whining and a sort of impetus to not do such a thing. I think the text is doing something different. Grumbling is a very specific word in the Bible. So when you see this word in 1 Corinthians 10:10, Paul says in this verse, "We must not put Christ to the test as they did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did when they were destroyed by the destroyer." Did you hear that? That Paul is talking about this instance where someone is destroyed by God himself for grumbling? Hardly seems fitting. What's he talking about? 1 Corinthians 10:10, Philippians 2:14. Paul is here invoking the story from Numbers 14. And in Numbers 14, the Israelites are roaming the desert. They've been freed by God out of Egypt after 400 years of slavery. And they're out roaming around, and God has done all of these miraculous things to save them. And he's promising them this deliverance into a land. And the people go, and they see that the land is well fortified, and that the armies and the people are giants, and their weapons are great. The people get very scared. And this is what they say. They say, "Would that we had died in Egypt." Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our children will become prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Now think about this for a second. Remember all that God has done for his people. Remember the Nile turning to blood? Remember the story of the plagues of locusts, the killing of the firstborn? Remember how God took his people out and he parted the Red Sea in front of them? They walked through it, and then as the Egyptian soldiers gave chase, God just crashed the ocean on top of them and killed them. Remember all these miraculous things that happened? God has done an incredible thing to deliver his people. And now here they stand on the precipice of the next great promise of God. And they say to themselves, let's turn back. We would rather die in Egypt. What? What they decide here is that God's promise is not good enough. That they've seen all the things that God has done, but when they look to what he's about to do and what he has promised to do, they think to themselves, we can't trust this God. He can't do this for us. Our children and our wives are going to be taken for us. And Numbers 14 says that they grumbled. They grumbled. See, here we're getting to the heart of the matter. The grumbling of the people is not the same as the grumbling of my kids when the broccoli shows up on the dinner plate. The grumbling of the people of Israel is not the same as what comes out of my mouth when I hit the alarm in the morning and I get out of bed for another day of labor and toiling. The grumbling of the people of Israel is categorically and unequivocally different than the whining I do in my everyday life. When Israel grumbles, it is a direct objection, a grievance leveled at the goodness of God. When Israel grumbles, they're saying, God, you are not trustworthy. You are not somebody that we can believe. We're going to whine and grumble about what you have done. This is like Adam and Eve in the garden. Isn't this what they do? That what Satan tempts them with is the idea that God is not really good. You should question his goodness. That somehow he's holding something back from them. See, when Paul uses this word grumble, he's not talking about trivial complaining about the weather outside or the service at a restaurant. Oh, it's so bad. I can't have it. You know, he's not talking about that. He's talking about questioning God's goodness and faithfulness to his people. So when Paul says, do all things without grumbling, he means something far weightier than not complaining. When Paul says that the way to be presented as blameless and innocent on the judgment day of Christ, he doesn't mean be a get-along guy and a team player when you show up to church. No, Paul is saying, in the face of a relentlessly perverted generation that surrounds you, hold fast to Christ. Grab a hold of Jesus. Do not leave your faith behind. Do not do as the Israelites of old did, who having received the miraculous deliverance by the hand of God himself, immediately turned away. Immediately decided that God's promises weren't good enough. Now, what Paul is saying here is, do not do as they did. You have received just as miraculous a deliverance, just as an expensive of a freedom. Paul is saying, do not do what they did and turn around having received that, turning around and disbelieving the promises for what is next. We might say that what Paul is actually talking about here is perseverance in the faith. The command is to persevere in the faith. What he's telling the people is, trust God in the battle. Believe when it's hard. Believe when it feels like everything around you is saying that God is not to be trusted and that you have to do it on your own. Paul is saying, persevere in the faith. Do not grumble. Do not dispute God. Hold fast to the word of life. Then Paul gives two reasons in this passage. He gives two reasons for why a people like you should persevere in their faith. And this is the first one in verse 16. He says, hold fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ, I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. By holding fast, Paul means this idea of perseverance. By the word of life, he means that gospel, that message, that news, that we are hell bound. Except that this one Jesus has come and taken our place, such that he receives the wrath and damnation of God, and we receive the freedom and the welcome into salvation. Paul's saying, hold fast to the word of life. And he says that holding fast, it will prove fruitful, not for today necessarily, but for the day of judgment that is to come. When he talks about this day of Christ, he's talking about the return of Jesus when he comes to judge the living and the dead. And Paul says that on that day, you need to persevere in your faith so that you can be presented as blameless, as innocent, without blemish before Jesus himself. And the question I think becomes, is Paul here suggesting a gospel of works? Is Paul saying that if I manufacture enough good faith to be considered blameless, will everything go all right with me on that day of judgment? I think it's very difficult to say that that's what Paul meant. But I think we can say this, that a person whose faith is absent in their life is going to face judgment for such things one day. That people who have tasted the glory of God and have turned away, grumbled against the Lord, said that what he does and how he does it is not good enough for them, will be held accountable. And so what Paul is telling the Philippians here is that your perseverance has an eternal accountability about it. It's not just, did you show up to church? It's not just, did everybody think you were a good Christian? No, he's saying that Christ is going to stand before you one day. And there is going to be an accountability for your faith. Paul is saying that your perseverance has eschatological weight to it. It has end times accountability. That's his first reason for calling us to a perseverance in the faith. Here's the second one. He says you're to persevere in the faith because it has a missional purpose. That your endurance and trust in God over the long haul is about more than you. That your faith isn't simply me and Jesus cooped up in a little world, but God has a grander and more missional purpose to your enduring in the faith. He says it, hold fast to the word of life in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. That the purpose of you holding fast is that you would be a light for a crooked generation. Now let me take a second to talk about a crooked generation. The Greek here is really interesting. You know, the word crooked is scolia. And so what Paul is saying is that this generation has a curved heart. It has a twisted, that is a perverted mind. And I think that cannot be forgotten. You know, because we're so inundated with all of the perverted, twisted ways of a generation that we, the people of truth, forget. This is not the way that God would have it. We cannot become immune and forget, immune to the evil that is around us. You know, the other night, it's the middle of the night. This might have happened to you. I'm sure it did. I'm laying in bed, and I'm dead asleep, and all of a sudden, my phone makes that eerie noise. And it's an Amber Alert. Did you get this one a couple weeks ago? That Birmingham girl that was kidnapped? And so I'm startled up. And I go over to my phone, and I'm thinking it's a tornado. You know, because we've been getting all these tornadoes lately, and you know, you kind of jump out of bed, and you're thinking, grab the kids, and duck in the hallway, and do all that kind of stuff. And so, like, boom, I'm up, and I'm going, and I grab my phone, and I look at it, I'm like, it's an Amber Alert. You got to be kidding me. And I'm completely annoyed, and then I go back to sleep. And then the next couple days later, I happen to be flipping through the news, and I see that they found the girl. I guess she had been killed and put in a dumpster or something. I didn't even pay attention enough to know what fully happened on it. I just changed the channel. Went back to SportsCenter. And I become so immune to a wicked and twisted generation that, like, I don't even blink at the alert that the child's kidnapped, murdered, thrown in the dumpster. Doesn't even affect me. Not even a big deal. You know, I know I've said this many times in here, and I will continue to say it many times in here for the exact point that I'm trying to make, but I don't want us to forget what a twisted and perverted generation it is that we allow this tragedy of abortion to go on among us. You know, that how can a people like us murder the innocent by the millions? How can we take the forceps and rip off and squish their heads? Pull them out. Toss them away. And I'm sorry for being so, I'm not sorry for being graphic about it, actually. Because that's what happens. And nobody wants to talk about that. You know, you remember the guys that filmed the Planned Parenthood doctors and they got, like, taken to jail because what evil doesn't want is for people to wake up and to realize that this is wicked. It's a twisted and perverted generation. They would like you to forget that. You know, last weekend, we killed the leader of ISIS. You know, we brought to justice a person who had brought about the genocide of the Kurdish people, who had killed innocent Americans, Christians. A very, very bad person. And I'll tell you the truth, I had all forgotten about the genocide happening over there. I'm way more concerned about what I'm going to eat for lunch at Taco Mama than the genocide of Christians around the world. It's a twisted and crooked generation. The amount of illicit sexual content that I consume during the course of normal media consumption would be called pornographic to a generation before me. I'm not talking about what we deem as pornographic. I'm talking about what's on my Netflix, what's on my cable. I remember the, I don't know how many years ago it was, 7, 8 years ago, I watched Orange is the New Black for the first time. And don't go watch it if you haven't seen it, but if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, it was such illicit, disgusting content on it that the first time I saw it, I was shocked. Like, I turned it off immediately. I felt a pit in my stomach. I couldn't even believe that this sort of thing was available without, like, a lot of warning in front of it. I don't even blink an eye anymore when I see stuff like that. I mean, it is just so a regular part of my life that I think watching illicit sexual content is just kind of what it is. It's a twisted and crooked generation. And the evil one would like you to forget that fact. He would like to say that, oh, you know, those comments about illicit behavior, come on, that's just preacher talk, you know, like that's just silly stuff that old conservative people worry about, you know. And you realize I realize I'm getting older because I speak to a younger generation who doesn't even think twice about all of this trash that's consumed, and I sit there looking at it like, I can't believe you're doing this. And I know the generation that was ahead of me does the same thing with me. You know, I just think, oh, they're just old fuddy-duddies. They don't really know how it is today. No, they know how it is. It's wicked. It's twisted. It's crude. It's evil. And it's the generation that we live in the midst of, and it's one that constantly opposes you. But God, in the middle of it, has called us to live as lights, not in, but for a crooked and twisted generation. The mistake Christians have made for many years is to think we're going to huddle up and just sort of duck under the onslaught. No, that's not what God says. God says you're to shine as lights to a twisted and crooked generation. And there's two mistakes that we often make when it comes to this sort of shining as lights in a crooked generation. And I think the first is, when we begin to talk about things like this, I think we should tread very lightly and very humbly when we talk about a crooked and twisted generation. Because what we're quick to do with phrases like this is to draw lines and to develop a mentality of us versus them. Now, I'm not trying to let us off the hook. I'm not trying to say, you know, I believe there's evil. I just told you that. You heard that, right? So quiet today. You heard that, right? I believe in evil. There are forces that oppose. There is a gospel truth, a primal gospel truth that says that when we go come to Christ, we go from being enemies of God to friends of God. God himself has laid out a certain line. But what I'm trying to say to you is, I think we ought to hold that truth very humbly. That truth that we've gone from death to life, that by the blood of Christ, we have been welcomed no longer as enemies, but as friends. Because we often, too often, want to draw lines and say it's us versus them, when we know it is as much us as it is them. We know we watch as much pornographic material as they do. We know we are just as immune and just as culpable for a culture of abortion as they are. We know that we are just as apt to lose our tempers. We know that we are wrought with envy, that greed is pervasive in this room. We know that we are as sexually depraved as they are. And sometimes when we begin to think about this kind of, you know, this us versus them, or this wicked and crooked generation, what happens is we get thirsty, we get excited, because it's like, finally, we can justify ourselves. We can draw a line and claim ourselves good and them bad, and everything will be great. But our consciences whisper something different. Our consciences tell us, we're as much us, we're as much them as they are us. That our hearts are crooked and twisted and perverted places. And this is what's so interesting. I think the text even bears this out. If you look at the context of this phrase, crooked and twisted generation, it is a direct quote out of Deuteronomy 32:5, which Amy read for you earlier. And what's happening in this verse is that Moses is prophesizing about what will happen to the people when they go into the land and God conquers it for them and they flourish and there's affluence and abundance. He says that generation will become a crooked and twisted generation. What's so interesting about Deuteronomy 32:5 is that the crooked and twisted generation is the people of God. It's not them that Moses is saying, it's us. Be careful how you draw lines between them and us, between the saved generation and a twisted generation. You may be more twisted than your heart wants to let you admit. Here's the second mistake. If the first mistake about the twisted and crooked generation is to think we aren't them, the second mistake is to think they can't be us. You know, we love to draw lines and to put people there. I mean, think about this in our life. We do it with our football teams. You know, we pick a team, you know, it's us versus the world. We do this with our politics. It's Republican, it's Democrat. And nary are the two to cross lines. Like, could there be a graver sin in the state of Alabama than to go from being an Alabama fan to being an Auburn fan? Or vice versa? I mean, it doesn't happen, right? You can't even conceive of such a thing. I mean, I know kids from this church, they grow up Alabama fans, they'll go to Auburn, there's still room for Alabama. We draw a line, we stay on. Republican and Democrat doesn't happen, right? I mean, when's the last time you saw a politician change parties? No, that's who you are, that's what you are, and you stay there. And what happens is we get so used to doing that, we do it with the gospel. Shame on us. We draw the lines, and we say, here's the evil ones, and here's the good ones. And everybody's set, and we're going to lock the gate, and we're going to throw the key away, and that's going to be all that there is to say about it, that you're on this side, and I'm on this side, and that's what it's going to be. The problem is the gospel doesn't work that way. That God is in the business of saving a twisted and a crooked generation. That he's in the business of transforming this twisted generation into objects of his mercy. And I think this is why Paul says here that we're to shine as lights among a twisted and crooked generation. We shine as lights so that those in the darkness might come to know Christ. I was at the Young Life banquet last weekend. Young Life is a Christian ministry to high school students here in town. I love the evangelistic ministry of Young Life. I'm personally thankful that they entered my life and were a part of my salvation story. What I was reminded of as I'm sitting at that banquet was this very thing, how we just label people. And Young Life, to its credit, and the reason that God has blessed that ministry over the years is that they refuse to see the boundary line as steadfast. That they don't look at a teenager and say, that's a bad kid. That's a kid that can't do the Christian thing. That what Young Life does is they look at every single kid and they think to themselves, this is a kid that God may be saving. And it is none of my business to decide who God is saving and who God is not saving. That I'm called to go. I'm called to be a light to shine in the darkness. and to watch the Lord by the power of the Spirit transform people from death to life, from enemies to friends. Look, if you're sitting here today and you're one of these people that you know, maybe you haven't been to church in a long time, maybe, you know, the words are big and a little bit confusing, and you're thinking, I don't know, maybe this isn't for me. Our God is in the business of taking those who are far from Him and saving them by the blood of Christ. And if you know Christ, you ought to be refreshed. You ought to be bathing in the truth that you were once lost, searching, wandering. Except for the grace of Jesus Christ. We got this issue of the transgendered issue. And I can feel this in Christianity because, you know, we're sort of struggling with the fact of how do we hold the truth and not give in to sin, but also at the same time, what that leads us to do is to draw a line and say, you know, anybody who's struggling with their gender is part of the crooked and twisted generation. They're perverted people. And I think we have a choice to make. And I think what we have to realize is that there is a lie and an evil one in the midst of it. You know, what Satan wants to do is he wants to insert a truth into people's heart that God has not fearfully and wonderfully made them. He wants people to believe the lie that their gender or their sexuality is wrongly put, that God has wrongly formed them, and that they're in the business of correcting it. But what we can't do is look at these people and just say, hey, you're over there and you're stuck over there because, you know, you're transgender. That we look at those people and we think to ourselves, these are people that are broken, that are lost, that are searching, that are looking for the irreplaceable, unparalleled love of God, and they don't know where to find it. And so they're trying all kinds of things. Beloved, God has called us to shine His lights in the midst of a twisted and crooked generation, not to be the judge, not to close the door, lock it, and throw the key out, but as the people who would love, pray for, proclaim the goodness of God's love such that they might go from being a part of a twisted and crooked generation to being the beloved of God, saved for heaven. Let's pray.